You're listening to the winning literary show, Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, live with host Denise Turney, author of the books Long Walk Up, Portia, Love Pour Over Me, Spiral, Love Has Many Faces, and Rosetta's Great Hope. Turn up your dial and get ready for a blast of feature author interviews, 411 on book festivals, writing conferences, and so much more. Ready? Let's go.
Good Saturday morning out there, Off the Shelf Blog Talk Radio podcast world, from wherever you're tuning in to Off the Shelf Books Talk Radio, anywhere in the world. We've been on for 16 years and want to thank our loyal listeners, the many ways that people tune in, whether you tune in through iTunes or Google or just over the phone, chat room, etc. Thank you and welcome, welcome, welcome. I want to start with this thought, just to drop a thought in your mind this morning to kick it off. And this is from Roy Bennett. Don't be pushed around by the fears in your mind. Be led by the dreams in your heart. Don't be pushed around by the fears in your mind. Be led by the dreams in your heart. And that's from Roy Bennett. And that's a great way to start our December the 11th as we head in for those who celebrate Christmas, or everybody getting ready to close out another year. Think about you talking dreams and not being led by your fears. What did you promise yourself in January 2021 you were going to get done this year? You promised yourself you would let yourself have an experience this year. You would do better at something. Did you keep your promise to yourself? Did you keep your promise to yourself? There's still time to finish the year strong. And again, I thank you for joining us here at Off the Shelf. We have and I just love our guests. We have an awesome author on deck for you, and I learn from every guest who comes on. But before we get started talking about finishing strong, Pathways to Tremendous Success just came out November of this year, just last month. These are a weekly devotional. It's not like a religious book at all. It's weekly things you can do, techniques you can do that have been proven to work, that have been proven to work to help you get to where you want to be, to help you to have the experiences and the success you deserve and that you know you want, but you keep talking yourself out of. So I encourage you to stop what you're doing. It's an ebook and in print. You get paperback, hardback, or an ebook. Get a copy of Pathways to Tremendous Success by Denise Turney. Don't let this day go by. You want to start 2022 strong and finish this year strong. Get a copy of Pathways to Tremendous Success. And now let us go and meet our very special off-the-shelf guest. And our special off-the-shelf guest this morning is J.D. May. And J.D. is the author of the book Factor 7. What an interesting title. She's also a wife, mother, and traveler, having traveled to places like Mexico, Canada, Italy, and Greece. Go ahead, J.D. And in addition to being a writer, she loves to paint. She and her husband are animal activists, and she is a member of the Authors Marketing Guild. She is a true artist who is enjoying life. Please check J.D. May out online, you guys, at authorjdmay.com. And it's spelled just the way it sounds, AUTHORJDMAY.com. AuthorJDMay.com. And if you can find out even more info when you go to AuthorJDMay.com about her book Factor 7. We are absolutely honored to have her with us here on Off the Shelf this morning. Welcome to Off the Shelf, J.D.
Thank you. I'm honored to be on your show.
Oh, we're happy to have you. I always learn so much from every guest, and I know our listeners do as well, whether they listen live or in the archives. We've had thousands and thousands and thousands of listeners. So I'm just excited to hear what you share. But the first few questions, I let our guests know, I ask every guest like the first 3 to 4 questions, just so our listeners can get a little backstory on these guests before I start talking about their books. So to kick it off this morning, J.D., would you tell off-the-shelf listeners where you grew up and what life was like for you growing up?
You bet. I grew up in as far south Texas as you can go and not be in Mexico. And where Texas comes to the point down at the very, very southernmost end of it. And it was great. It was during the time where I could get on my bicycle or my horse and I could leave at 7 o'clock in the morning and go ride and not come home until dark 30 and nobody worried about you out in the country. And, you know, it was a wonderful wonderful place to grow up and a wonderful time to grow up.
Now, did you have to... Oh, go ahead.
Nope, I'm the only child.
Oh, okay.
I laugh and say I'm a lonely child, but I was never lonely.
Oh, good. It sounded like you had a lot to do, and then a lot of... You must have sounded like you enjoyed the outdoors, you saying, being out riding your bike and riding a horse. And Did you, for our listeners, as they think about how an author is developed or shaped, did you have a lot of friends close to you, or was that an instance growing up an only child where you had to use your imagination and your creativity because of where you grew up?
Pretty much the latter. I entertained myself. Of course, my parents were wonderful, and they were always there to, you know, to make things fun, but... As an only child and living in the country, it was after school, there wasn't anybody around to play with. And so, yeah, I learned to entertain myself. I've always had quite an imagination. And I think that my upbringing and making myself have to have my own imagination and not be entertained from outside sources, I think that helps with creativity with people. I do. A lot of times people get wrapped up in outside things and don't allow their mind to expand. And I think that partially my upbringing assisted me with where I went in life.
Awesome. Now, when you were a little girl, what did you want to be when you grew up? What did you dream of becoming when you were a kid?
Oh, I think I wanted to be an actress. I majored in drama in college and art, and I think there was a time I wanted to be an actress pretty much, but you know, I somewhere along the line that fell apart, and I started writing early high school and wrote short stories and silly poems and tried to write music lyrics, but I wasn't very good at that. And I think that's where my writing started. And, of course, I studied art and painting and drama in college, but the writing was always there. And I think that the theater also made a big impact on my writing because I write very visibly, where when you're reading my words, hopefully you will actually have a vision in your mind of where you are, what it looks like, what it smells like, which probably goes back to my theater days. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. See, and this is one thing I love about off-the-shelf interviews. As I listen to authors, I always want to go out and buy all their books because you learn more about them, and then as we start to talk more about Factor 7, but before we get to Factor 7, which is just a couple of questions away, but can you tell us, you talked about drama, you wanted to be an actress, you're painting and you were into the art.
Right.
Who or what in particular inspired you to pursue novel writing and book publishing?
Oh, I don't know if there was one in particular person. When I was in school, in San Miguel de Allende, Guanajuato, the state of Guanajuato in Mexico. I'm sorry I could not even repeat her name. It's been so long ago. But I had a teacher, a professor at the Instituto, and she was a writer, a painter, taught drama, and she was just so alive that I think she inspired me to pursue anything and know that if you really believe it, you can succeed in it. And I think that I learned that writing was really where I needed to be, because it fulfills me, and it takes me places in my mind that I probably would not discover. And one of the funny things that I say, and everybody thinks I'm a little bit cuckoo, is that my characters literally talk to me, and they tell me where they want to go, what they want to do. So I kind of get into the zone, and I think this particular professor taught me how to get into the zone and do where your imagination and your mind wants to take you without fearing of rejection and the fear of not being able to complete something. I think that she probably was as instrumental in that as anyone in my life.
Well, it's a blessing when those people cross your path, and when we gift other people with those same type of blessings as well. Now, you've traveled a lot.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
we've had other guests on who've traveled a lot, and I can only imagine this is something I always think everybody should travel. Definitely leave your hometown, and hopefully go to another country, because you start to not have such a tight view of things when you see other people thriving in different cultures, different ways
right.
of living. It's just helpful, I think. How has traveling, your travels, how has it impacted your writings?
Oh, tremendously. In fact, everything I write about spans the world. Factor 7 and the sequel that I'm working on now, I pull upon the places and the, as you say, the customs and things from these other places that I have been and friends that I have met, and my characters pick up like Rainey in Factor 7. She's from a friend of mine that was an American that married a cardiologist in Naples, Italy, and I kind of patterned her and where she was from my travels and being with my friend over there. And so it's tremendous. I think that you can pick up, like I say, you pick up on the smells of the places that you travel. Every country smells differently.
Wow.
You know?
I never heard anybody say
smell.
That.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the smells and all the sensory things that happen when you travel, the languages and the beauty and the antiquity of places like parts of Italy and Greece. I think all of that spurs your imagination of how was it when, and I think all of your senses are heightened when you're able to leave your little nest home and venture out. You learn so much.
Yes, and so now it is interesting what you said about smells. That's something I never heard before. Very interesting. On to Factor 7. Now, for our listeners, is Factor 7, is this a crime mystery? And keeping in mind the questions I ask is if nobody's ever heard of Always to the Authors, if nobody ever heard of your book before. So is Factor 7, is it a crime mystery or science fiction? And why did you choose this particular genre?
It's a suspense medical thriller. I don't think I could write anything but fiction, and because I think I can use my imagination writing fiction, where although I love and appreciate nonfiction, I'm just a fiction writer. And I chose it because I find medical thrillers just thrill me, for lack of a better word, and not to be redundant with the word. But I think that what science can do in medicine is exciting. And I think that you can, you know, science can be, and I've said this before, science can be your friend or it can be your enemy. And in Factor 7, it becomes an enemy.
Are there plans to turn Factor 7, and we're going to get into, for our listeners, we're going to get in and more deeply into the book and its makings and what the book is about. But are there plans to turn Factor 7 into a book series?
I don't know if it's going to be a full series, but there is a sequel, three quarters finished. And and the name, that the working title on it, which I imagine will be the title, is called Germline. And so it follows the same path of my characters, and some of them that survived Factor 7 are going to be in the sequel. It's very possible that there will be a third book. I'm not sure where we'll go from there, because I have some other ideas where I want to, that I want to write about. So, but as far as a sequel, yes, ma'am, it is. It's in the works.
Okay. Now, where did you get the idea for the book? Where did that come from?
Okay, this is really an odd story. I started writing the original Factor 7 in the early 90s. Now, that's a long time ago. And I lost my husband. I found out 2 weeks later afterwards that after he died that I was pregnant with my first child and only child. And so life happened, and I raised my daughter, put the book on the shelf, didn't do anything with it. And when she was in her last year in college, she found it, and she read the manuscript. And she said, Mom, you got to rewrite this, update it. It's too good. You got to do it. So it sat there for a couple of years that I didn't, and I'd look at it as I'd walk by my desk, sitting there, all those papers stacked up. And finally I sat down and wrote what Factor 7 is today. How it started, and I think where my interest lied in the 90s, was it was about the time that MERS and SARS and some of the viruses were emerging in the world, and I found interest in that, and I found a story that I could put with it. Factor 7 of today is just a small semblance of what Factor 7 was in the 90s, but the thought has been with me ever since that first manuscript. And so it's just my interest in viruses and how they can change the world.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. You wrote this book in the 90s. And in the 90s, I know it was HIV, AIDS.
Yes,
it
ma'am.
Was, like you said, I don't know if Ebola was out. But
Ebola was just emerging. SARS, MERS. Which, you know, those are the precursors, if you will, of the COVID-19. And I had no idea, of course, when I wrote it originally that there
my
was
goodness.
A world pandemic.
Oh, and so I'm like, this book, you talk about on time as far as, I'm thinking like a marketing. I mean, nobody wants any virus or disease, period. But
right.
the timing is almost uncanny or ironic that is coming out now. So far, listeners who are sitting on the edge of their seat and they want to know more about the book, particularly as it has a link to current international real-life events, can you give our off-the-shelf listeners an overview or a peek inside of Factor 7?
Sure. Factor 7 starts out with Sam Hawkins, who is a trauma doctor surgeon in Galveston, Texas. He is he's called to the emergency room, and one of his best friends is dying from something very odd that he had never seen before and quite hideous. He is catapulted from the death of his friend into just real fear of what was going on. He is approached by Rainey, who is an Italian infectious disease doctor who also knew his friend. And together they find out about a group of rogue international agents that have plans, diabolical plans, to use a man-made, manufactured virus to I guess you would say, cleanse the world of what they don't think is should be allowed to happen anymore. And they can't leave the situation to others because it's being buried, because of the backlash of the truth and the panic of the truth, that they are going, they have to find the information to get it back to someone. And what they go through is horrendous. They they go into Mexico to retrieve a journal written by the deceased friend, and they find out everything. Well, when they're in Mexico, they get kidnapped by the Mexican cartel who had partial financed this rogue group, and it's just horror from that point forward till the end of the book. They try to travel the world to find out how to eliminate this threat, which there's another conspiracy theory secret society that comes in and helps them. So it's a combination of the conspiracy theory with a lot of truth in it.
So the way it is now, was that the way the book was when you started it in the 90s, or did you change it after COVID-19, or was that the way?
Oh, no, I didn't change. I never touched the book after COVID-19, except I went back just before print and I think put in two places COVID-19 to update it. But no, ma'am, it's completely different. But the premise of a rogue virus being man-made was created in the 90s. And then, of course, I updated it. But
yeah,
I didn't use COVID-19 as the virus. The virus that is created in Factor 7 is a man-made virus. Could happen. I mean, it could happen, and maybe has happened, but it is completely different from what I wrote in the 90s. There's a lot of research I did, and I've been accused of maybe using too much science in my book, but I wanted it to be real enough that when you were reading it, you would say, "Man, this could really happen." And man, it really could happen.
Yes. Now, what is Dr. Sam Hawkins, what is he like? What drives him? What's his personality like? And when the story starts, is it just like, boom, he's right in the middle of this with his friend who's passed? Or do readers get a glimpse of what he's like, what drives him, what's his personality like?
In the beginning, Sam is bored with his life. He's got a bad marriage. It's dysfunctional. He buries himself in his work. He has lost the spark of life. He just kind of goes through the paces of day-to-day routine. He'd seen so much death and so much suffering in the trauma department, a level one trauma center where he was head of trauma, that he had become hardened. And when he met Rainey and found out what was going on and finally was convinced, because it takes him a long time to be convinced that what she's telling him is really happening. He can't believe that something like that really is true. And when he finally does, it's like he finds a reason to go on, a reason his wife has an affair and they divorce, and he's devastated. But by the time he meets Rainey, he's just at rock bottom, and she brings him out of it. He finds a purpose, and the purpose leads him to happiness in the very end, where
Yeah, don't tell us the ending, but that's sweet. Now, what did Sam's friend who passed away, what did he do for a living that caused him to come to know what he knows?
He was chief of staff at the hospital and was a researcher and a good friend of Sam Hawkins. He was much older. I have him somewhere in his 70s. And his son had been killed by a terrorist attack, and he never recovered from that. And he got involved with a group that he thought in his grief and in the way his mind had become tainted with the world, that what he was doing was righteous, although it would be genocide. And he takes his own life by using the virus to expose it to Sam in the night that he dies. But he's unable to tell him anything. And Sam, after the death, Sam knows something is going on, but he doesn't know what. And that's when Rainey comes in. She had been told about it through Dr. Roberts, who had died in the ER in front of Sam. And they together go after the situation to try to expose it and to eliminate the threat. And it's amazing what two people can do when they set their mind to it. And it's their travels and their fears and their horrors and what the world could become when people hate.
Yeah. Now, after Dr. Hawkins receives this cryptic message, does he continue to work as a surgeon, covering his tracks, or does he become more of a detective?
He becomes more of a detective. He takes a leave of absence from the hospital, and he becomes more of a detective. However, both of them are physicians and scientists, and so they use their knowledge to find out more about what's going on.
Okay.
And that's I'm sorry?
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and that's why both of them, and I made both of them be scientists and physicians, so it would be realistic that when they did discover something, they knew that they were looking at something that was very deadly.
Now introduce us to Ms. Rainey Arienzo. What is she like? What's her background like? What drives her, and what is she like? And have she and Sam worked together before?
No, they never met before Dr. Roberts died. Dr. Roberts had contacted her because her father was one of the world's most well-known infectious disease doctors, and they had met in Geneva, Switzerland. And Rainey's father knew what was going on, and he had been studying the particular Factor VII virus, and he was murdered. Rainey found out all about it, and then Dr. Roberts had told her to contact Sam Hawkins, that Sam would know what was going on too. And she met him in Galveston, and it took quite some time for her to convince Sam that it was not, that she was just not Looney Tunes. And once she was able to convince him, then they teamed up together with her information and the information that they uncover subsequent to their meeting.
Is she a tough woman? Is she?
Yes.
Oh, so she is. She's a tough woman.
She's a tough woman, but she's vulnerable. And in certain ways, I've made her. I made her be vulnerable, she and Sam end up in love, and they save each other accordingly. And but she's beautiful, she's sexy, but she's tough as nails.
I was gonna ask you if there's a romance, and is the romance, is it sweet, mysterious, or dangerous? You know how some people get together and it's like, oh no, now it's the, in the end, it's like the worst thing they could have ever done, and they both suffer because they got together, because it can create blind spots. When you start having romantic feelings for people, you can miss things. You can miss clues. You can see something and tell yourself, no, 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 that's not true. And you
right.
can end up in trouble. You can end up in trouble. So, but it sounds like theirs is like a good meant-to-be romance.
It is, but it starts out, she hates Sam. She thinks he's arrogant. He thinks she's crazy. And it takes a while for them to, but there's a spark that Sam has from the very first meeting, and you get a sense of it in the book, but you don't know where it's going to go. But yes, it ends up being a sweet love and an enduring love, but it's a ways getting there. And I will say that the book is definitely an adult read. Definitely.
Okay.
An adult reader.
Okay. Now, tell us about some of the other major and minor characters that helped to keep the Factor VII story moving forward.
Okay, Dr. John Albright. Dr. John Albright was a roommate of Sam Hawkins in medical school, University of Texas Medical School, and they hated each other. And John Albright was absolutely a genius. But he was such a narcissist that everything he did it for personal gain. He becomes involved with they bring him in to the evil society, the rogue agents. They need a scientist, and they get him. And because he has no morals. He does what they tell him to do, but he's also a bit of a rogue on his own. And he is, like I say, he is a narcissist. He can't. He wants everybody to know what a genius he is. And his whole thing is he wants the world to know who he is He becomes big trouble for Sam and Rainey. It goes all the way through the book. He's a good looking, handsome man that all the women fall for, and he thinks he's hot stuff.
Okay. Are there any others? Anybody who Not telling a story, but any others who are characters that off-the-shelf listeners would want to pay particular attention to?
Well, let's see. The big evil man, El Espino, which means the thorn in Spanish, and he is the cartel lord who you even... I try to make every one of my characters, the good, the bad, and the ugly, where at some point in time you have empathy for them. Necessarily sympathy, but you have empathy. And even as evil as Espino is, you begin to understand where he's coming from. And he's critical to the story. And really put Sam and Rainey through a lot of terror, but comes out on the other end, maybe where they don't hate him as much as they do in the beginning, if that makes sense.
A lot of change in character development, and you can see just like in real life, in Factor VII. how early into this story, and you have some very good kind of villains in the story and the deep connections that they have, like Sam's college roommate. I think that is so clever. How early into the story do others, in the story itself, not readers, but other characters in the story, how early into it do they become aware of what Sam and Rainey know?
Well, some know already, and you can't know that they know, and you don't know that they know until almost the very end of the book.
Wow.
And they deceive, like I say, that, you know, that they there's people that deceive them and lie to them all the way through.
Oh, my God,
there's,
yes.
There's an FBI agent who knows the truth but has to hide the truth. There's evil in the law enforcement and the governments. They know the truth. There, and you know these people, and you travel through the book with them, but you don't know until later in the book what's going on.
Mm.
There's
this is a mystery.
There's conspiracy. There's love. There's sex. There's hate, and there's fear. It's every emotion that I think that a human being can have, you will have as you're reading this book.
Mm. Now, will readers spot anybody with people being deceptive and manipulative? Will they spot and know any character in Factor 7 who Sam and Rainey can truly, truly trust? Or is it just Sam and Rainey? They're on their own.
They're on their own.
Wow.
They're on their own, but you think they can. You think they can trust people. And there is one FBI agent that they can trust, but he knows too much. And that's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Now, just how much from real life, this is a story you started in the 90s. You were going to just do a life event. You just put it on a shelf. Thankfully, you didn't dump it somewhere. And just say it ain't nothing's coming of it. It's like 30 years later. But just how much from real life, when you wrote this story 30 years ago, just how much from real life do you incorporate into Factor 7?
Pretty much. I think that some of the characters, I mean, obviously the characters are, and like I say, they tell me where they want to go, but they're from my imagination, but they're from people that I know. They're composites of people that I know, of stories I have read. They're composites. Like Sam is a good old Texas boy. I mean, he'd rather wear his Stetson and boots than hospital scrubs. He jokes when he's nervous. He makes a joke. That comes from my dad. My dad was a wonderful businessman, but when he found himself in a predicament or the conversation, my dad was funny. He could have been a stand-up comedian, but that was a way for him to cover perhaps for shyness, and I put that into Sam. Rainey is maybe what I would love to be. The, you know, not really allowing things to get under my skin, and she is that way. You know, she's tough, and she has vulnerability, but maybe not. You know, maybe I see it that maybe parts of her I would have liked to have been.
Okay.
You know, you create your characters from composites. I think everybody does who writes. And,
and all
of my characters are that way, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What have readers been saying about Factor 7?
Well, they've been saying that it's a page-turner, It's a thriller. I had one friend call me in the middle of the night, and well, middle of the night for me, I think it was about 11 o'clock, and tell me that she was mad at me, that her husband was not home at the time, and she was reading one of the racy parts of the book. It's, that's a true story. It's, you know, I hear everything from it's just they can't put it down. It's a number one Amazon bestseller, has been 3 times.
Awesome.
And it's in the top 10. It's been in the top 10 Amazon bestsellers. I think it's 6 times that it's been in the top 10. So
awesome. People
are reading it. People are loving it. And I just gave one to a man that's putting wallpaper up in my parents' house right now, and he said it's one of the most intriguing books he's ever read. And so, you know, you don't have to have a medical background. You don't have to enjoy it. I mean, I think anybody from any walk of life who has lived, particularly has lived through the last 2 years that we have lived through in the world, the pandemic. And again, I wrote Factor 7 before the pandemic. So let's be clear that I did not use Factor 7 as
right.
premise of my book.
You wrote
book.
It 30 years ago. Yeah, you
wrote it
30
years
ago.
Right.
Right.
And so you understand a little bit, and I don't think I'm giving away the book. Factor 7, and I did not know this at the time when I wrote it and named it that in the 90s. Factor 7 is a protein produced by the liver. And people who bleed do not have this particular protein, Factor 7. It binds with other proteins to coagulate the blood. So that will tell you a little bit about the virus.
Ah, interesting. What was the most fun part about writing this story?
You know, writing in general is fun to me. I would rather write than do anything in the world. I think the most fun is just sitting down and seeing the pages come. And sometimes I write so fast that every word is misspelled. And, you know, because
you just want to get the story down.
I just get the story down. And I get up in the middle of the night. I love writing so much that I dream my books, and I dream chapters.
Oh.
So I'll get up in the middle of the night, and I'll start writing, and then I'll read them the next day. And like I say, every word will have been misspelled. There will be, you know, no punctuation that's correct. But it's just to get the story down. Somebody's telling me. In, you know, I say it's my character, somebody, somehow, my brain, whatever is telling me, just get it down. So it's fun. I mean, I think the most fun is just to see the book evolve. And I don't write like other people, and any professor or teacher who does creative writing will poo-poo me and say, I don't know what I'm doing. I never do an outline, and I never know how my book's going to end.
Wow, but you wrote one that's hitting a bestseller list, so that's awesome. Now tell us about a part of the Factor 7 that kept you up as the author.
I think that the things that kept me up was when they get to Mexico and wanting to make sure I do that part of the Mexican cartel in a correct way. I wanted to make sure that it was written the way it really could happen in real life. And I think that probably was what kept me up. But the story itself wakes me up. And that's when I get up and write. And I will. I think it's those early morning hours where your mind is half dreaming, half sleeping. I become more creative during those hours. But I will sit. I don't know what writer's block is. I've never experienced it. I will sit at the computer writing for 6-8 hours and not even get up.
Wow.
Because I get so into what I'm writing that I feel like I'm literally in the place, what I'm writing about and the action, I become part of it. And I know people think I'm crazy, but my husband, thank goodness, he just fixes his own sandwich and and he goes out and feeds the tribe of cats in the yard, you know, because he knows I don't want to get up from the computer, and so he doesn't bother me.
Oh, my goodness. You know what? To get into a story, I think that's the greatest reward as an author, when you get into the heart of a story and you're just being rewarded by creating a story but also feeling connected to it and a part of it. It's just very rewarding to me as an artist. I can imagine for a painter, it's probably, you're creating this thing. That is like the biggest reward to me. Now, you also attended the Galveston Book Festival. Tell us what that experience was like.
Oh, that was fun. And you know, being the beginning of the book and part of the book is set in Galveston, Texas, I think that was fun. Yeah, we had a good time. We were down on the Strand, the historical part of Galveston, and people were wandering around the antique shops, and I was among some really fine Texas authors and children's books and self-help books, as well as a couple of thrillers, fiction writers. And it was great fun. I think every book signing I've done and things like that, you know, you learn so much more when you can visit with other people who are writers.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you what they go through, and that makes it fun, because everybody's experience in writing, I think, is different.
Yes.
So it's, you know, it's
fun. Would you recommend, is that for a certain type of book, is it, like you said, children's books, is it a wide range of book types that you saw there that did well? And would you recommend to other authors that they attend the Galveston Book Festival? Is it a good way to build your brand, get more exposure for your books? Do a lot of readers come out?
Yes. There's a couple of them in Texas that I would recommend. There's going to be one in April in Wimberley, Texas, which is probably one of the most beautiful places in Texas. It's on the river, and it's the Texas Hill Country, which you just don't get any prettier than that. And it's a little bitty town, you think that you're going to see cowboys riding up and tying their horses up in front of a saloon. That's what it looks like. And we're going to be there the 9th of April. There's another one in May in Seguin, Texas, which is in the Hill Country, kind of near Austin. So there's lots of activity in Texas with authors right now. And, yes, I recommend authors get involved. And if you don't have anything to do those weekends, you can go to, you know, you can go and find the festivals online, Texas book festivals, and you can find them online, and they'd be worth a drive from, if you're coming from Louisiana or New Mexico or Oklahoma, it'd be a pretty quick drive for you to get to some of them. And I think they'd be well worth the time to do it, because it's fun.
Okay. Now, you said, I wanted to talk to you, for our listeners who themselves may want to become an author and they want to be where you are now. You had briefly spoken about it. You said you don't use outlines, but what writing process do you follow? Do you do character sketches? When you sit down to start writing a story, what's the process? Do you need to be in a certain environment? Do you need where it's totally quiet? Do you play certain types of music? What is the process for you taking a story from A to Z?
I think that the way I write is I have created something in my mind before I even touch the computer, kind of where I want to go, where I want to start, and have the idea. And then I just sit down and I start writing, and I write every day. And it may not be a lot every day, but I write every day. I don't do anything like an outline. I don't do any character sketches. I've already created my character in my head, pretty much, but they grow. And as, you know, I keep going back. You know, Sam Hawkins and Rainey told me where they wanted to go and how they wanted to grow. And so without doing an outline or a sketch about my characters, as the book evolved and the story evolved, the characters evolved with it.
So and when you say the character told you, is it a dream? You're having a dream and the character is telling you in a dream? How is that happening when you say that?
I'm sitting at the computer and I'm writing about Sam, and the next thing I'm just writing and I don't know where it's coming from. And it's coming from my mind, but they become real people to me. And as odd as this may sound, when I'm not writing about Sam and Rainey, I know I'm going to miss them.
Wow.
Because they're real people.
Yeah, you know, early in my writing, I experienced that. I would dream about stories that
mm-hmm.
I was writing. So, and I've heard other authors say that the character told them, this has to happen to me.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So you just sit down and it just flows. It just comes out of you. It just
yes.
pours out of you. Can
yes.
you share, now you've had success with Factor 7, can you share, I was last night, before I asked you this, I was last night laying in bed watching on my smart TV a YouTube interview with these people are in the UK, but an author who's independently published. She's done very well. She wants to continue to be, but she has a team. She has a publicist. She has a personal assistant. She's done well. She sold over 2 million copies of her books in the UK, and she sells them Apple, Amazon. She never took out an Amazon ad, nothing, for when I'm getting ready to ask you this question. She said she spent like maybe $300 on ads a month, and that was
yes.
it for all her ads. And her books
yeah.
just took off and just sold. Can you share for our listeners who themselves, again, they're doing what you're doing, they want to do what you do, and they would like to have success, because I've heard some authors say they haven't sold one book, or they
yeah.
haven't even managed to sell 50 books, and they've just tried everything. Can you
yeah.
share 3 to 4 steps that you take that you found to be effective for you at getting the word out about your books?
Well, I think that having a publicist is good, but not everyone can afford a publicist.
Right. They are expensive. Yeah.
They're very expensive. Now, I have a consultant now that is... I had one that helps book things like with you, and you wouldn't have known about me possibly without her. But I have one now that really knows a lot of people in the business, and so he's getting me a lot of podcasts, a lot of online magazine articles. I've had 6 online magazine articles written in the last 2 months. I do think you have to spend a little money with people that are in the business to get it out, get the word out. But I also think that Facebook is really good. I have a personal Facebook, you know, and then I have my Factor 7 author J.D. May Facebook. And I got a lot of followers with just putting ads, just using the boost of ads on Facebook, I think, and that's relatively inexpensive to do. I did a lot of also direct mail to bookstores, trying to set up signings, personal appearances, word of mouth. I've asked everybody who has read the book to either leave a review or tell somebody about it. I think that reviews are wonderful, but they're really hard to get because people don't find it important in their day in life to read a book and then leave a review unless you ask them. So don't be afraid to ask people to tell people about it. The other thing is you're going to have to give away books free. And don't be afraid of spending a little money on giving away some of your books, because that will get somebody to read it that might not have read it otherwise, and mm-hmm. then ask them to tell people. The other thing is, for example, on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, for example, be sure you really get correct keywords for searches.
Yes. Yeah.
Those are probably as important as anything are the keywords. And if your keywords are not working and your book is not selling, change those keywords
mm-hmm.
until people start searching. You can't just, like my book, I say it's a medical thriller or a suspense thriller. I can't just put those as keywords. You have to have other things like crime and just rack your brain about keywords, and that will help people find your book.
The only other thing I could say, and
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, is you have to be patient. You have to be real patient because it may not happen overnight for you.
Yeah, you might, and some people's books, it could come back years after, and you like, because there are people who are no longer here anymore, and they have, like, I think of Zora Neale Hurston, she was almost penniless as an author. She
right.
had book festivals and everything for her. And in the arts, Vincent van Gogh is like the primary example. I don't even think he made $100 off of any of his paintings.
Right.
You can't get a Vincent van Gogh painting for less than, $400,000? But he made nothing. He made nothing in his life.
Right.
Yeah. And it wasn't
right. That's another
all
thing about the arts, and writing is an art, painting is an art. You better like what you're doing.
Oh yeah.
And not look for the money. If you're looking to make money, and that's your primary goal, you're in the wrong business. You better like it. Not to say that you're not going to make money, and you shouldn't make money, because of course you should. But if you don't, you better love what you're doing. And it better be a success in your own mind that you were able to write that book, paint that painting, and it's icing on the cake when you make money off of it. But you better enjoy it yourself. And I think that enthusiasm of loving the art of writing help sell your work.
Yeah,
and without I think you're dead in the water.
Yeah, I agree. Because you go a lot of anything in life, ups and downs, twists and turns, and that's the greatest payoff when you do what you love, to me. But you also need to pay your bills, so
right.
you got to be smart
right.
about it.
You do. Right.
Now, as this interview, I have loved having you on.
Thank you.
J.D. May, the author of the book Factor 7. Where can off-the-shelf listeners get a copy of Factor 7?
Any place books are sold, your fastest is going to be Amazon, of course, because they probably will have it to you in 2 days. But
okay.
Any place books are sold. If they don't have it on the shelf, they can certainly order it and get it in. But any of the major bookstores, your smaller bookstores, and I always say, try your local bookstore, because I believe that bookstores are almost extinct, and I really encourage people to you know, buy your books locally if you can. But
yeah,
any place books are sold, you can buy Factor 7.
And if you're on any social media networks, can you tell our listeners where they can find you on social media?
Sure. You can go to author J.D. Bay, authorjdmay.com/factor7, my website.
Okay. And you have links to your social media there?
Yes,
people
I do.
Can find you. Okay. So you guys get...
And you can also reach me personally, and I will respond to as many as I can, authorjdmay@gmail.com.
Okay. We have been delighted to have J.D. May here with us. And, again, her website is author J.D. May, AUTHORJDMAY.com. She's the author of the book Factor 7. If you came in midstream or late, no worries. To the interview, once it finishes streaming, you can listen to it in its archives. And JD, I will send you or your publishers a link to the interview once it finishes streaming as well. Thank you so much. I truly enjoyed your interview and your book Factor 7. Wish you much, much success. What an intriguing, suspenseful, it's got romance in it. Everything readers love is almost in like Factor 7. Thank you again, JD. To our listeners, thank you for being here with us. As I always tell you, you are amazing. You're awesome. You are incredible. Go out and create a fabulous day for yourself. See you back here next Saturday, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We will have another fabulous author to introduce you to. Thank you, thank you, thank you, JD.
Thank you. Thank you so very much for hosting me.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.